You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
Greetings, LawPod UK listeners out there. We're delighted to have reached a milestone of 400,000 listens in quite a short time. And by way of celebration, we've put together some of the best moments in our interviews over the very strange months of the past year. We started 2020, appropriately, with a discussion about compensating people for medical negligence. But none of us in the interview, at any rate, had the smallest inkling of the crisis that was about to engulf the National Health Service. So there we were, innocent of the forthcoming mayhem, discussing the best way of conducting medical claims with retired QC James Badenoch and David Hart QC, speculating on medical accidents. The no-fault systems in Sweden and New Zealand are not readily transferable to a country with a much larger population, such as the United Kingdom. In James Badenoch's view, it's simply unrealistic to aspire to a system whereby you can obtain compensation for a medical accident without proving fault.
One of the things that we ought to remember is why tort law exists in complex civilized societies. It exists to set standards for those of us whose actions may harm others to meet. It exists to reflect society's disapprobation of bad practice, whether it's chopping a tree down in your garden carelessly or wielding the surgeon's scalpel carelessly. It exists to provide for those whose lives have been damaged through no fault of their own, where they're left with needs that they can't fulfill, to provide them with compensation. It also, in the end, provides a system whereby the standards which the tort law imposes are publicly declared intermittently by judgments in courts. And thus it is proper to say, I think, that tort law and its application to all of us serves to maintain high standards in the way we act in our daily lives, whether we're designers of bridges, drivers of cars, or doctors or surgeons.
Well, tort law took something of a back seat over lockdown, when lawyers started sharpening their weapons vis-à-vis the erosion of civil rights under the new rules. My interview with biolaw expert Niall Colan took place back in March, and since then there have been a number of challenges to the government's lockdown policies based on human rights law. How could the guarantee of basic common law civil liberties, and particularly the right to liberty in Article 5 of the European Convention of Human Rights, have been overridden so easily?
Article 5 is one of the most important articles of the Convention, and what it essentially does is set out a very limited set of grounds on which people can be deprived of their liberty. So the traditional case is imprisonment, but it can extend much beyond that. And in this case, what's relevant is it also extends to house arrest, at least in certain cases, and in particular, it seems fairly clear that permanent house arrest, i.e. 24 hours a day, with no exceptions, amounts to deprivation of liberty within Article 5. And when that applies, the safeguards set out in that article are triggered. So the question then is what the state has done and the procedure that's followed is compliant with that article.
I know we don't have any current case law immediately applicable to this, but in your article you do mention a number of cases in the past relating to other justifications for breaching Article 5, in particular the case of Enhorn and Sweden of 2005. Why is that case so important?
Well, Enhorn and Sweden seems to be the only case on the part of Article 5.1e which allows detention on the grounds of prevention of the spreading of infectious disease. And that was a case where someone who was HIV positive was told not to go and kind of infect other people, disobeyed various restrictions linked to that, and then was detained under this article for around 18 months. And that was found to be contrary to the convention, and in that article, by analogy with other parts of Article 51E, the court set out a two-part test for whether detention is compatible with that article, with that provision. The test is whether the spreading of the disease is dangerous for public health or safety, which certainly is true in our case, and secondly, whether detention of the person infected is the last resort in order to prevent the spreading of the disease because less severe measures have been considered and found to be insufficient to safeguard the public interest. And so in our case, while it's difficult to analogize here, you can see two immediate issues. The first is, on its face, that requires that the person who's detained actually be infected. Obviously, in this case, for fairly good reasons, we are not simply isolating people, we're also quarantining them. We're also quarantining people where we don't know whether they're affected. And I set out in the article a few reasons why I think it's likely that this will be interpreted broadly enough to include those who are reasonably suspected of being infected.
Many more constraints on our liberties have been put in place since I spoke to Niall. A month after that interview, Dominic Ruck-Keen and Dara Coffey of One Crown Office Row considered the likely attitude of the judiciary to challenges to lockdown and movement restriction regulations.
The starting point, as I say, is that by saying we are not able to leave our own homes without reasonable excuse, then that is in effect detention. Now, that detention can easily be made lawful, provided that there is a legal basis for it. But that's what you have to have under common law in order for it to be not unlawful detention. And the doubts that have been raised by various commentators, whether Lord Sumption or indeed Lord Sandhurst, is the question as to whether the regulations themselves are ultra vires, so are lawful as a means to make what would otherwise be unlawful detention lawful. But there's a separate point as to whether under public law grounds, the policy and practice surrounding the implementation of the regulations is sufficiently clear and consistent to make that potentially unlawful detention lawful.
That sort of balancing between the desire to protect life on one hand, again, we constantly hear the refrain on the TV and various other places, stay home, protect the NHS, save lives. Between that sort of an aspect and then those other civil liberties we're more used to having untrammeled in this country, certainly, it raises an interesting question in relation to those sort of balancing, which really, I think, has to be asked and has to be monitored to an extent.
I would agree. And I think you step back and you look at this in the broader context of this particular government has been quite vocal about the degree to which it is unhappy about what they see as judicial activism. And there was already ideas about reforming judicial review, about trying to restrict to some degree the extent to which the courts can, as the government or some within the Conservative Party would see as unjustified and unconstitutional politicisation of the courts. That would be a context which would be very much, I suspect, in the judiciary's minds were there starting to be legal challenges raised to either the government's policy pre, during and even post the pandemic in general and the lockdown in particular. And I think the courts would be very much wanting to try to give a margin of discretion to the government for what is an unprecedented situation. It's not an unprecedented scenario because this clearly was something which the government has and governments generally across the world have been aware might happen at some point. But nevertheless, how this actually plays out in practice is unprecedented. And across all the Western democratic countries, broadly speaking, with the odd outliers such as Sweden, have imposed extremely drastic lockdown measures. And when you look at the Article 2, or you're looking at deprivation of liberty and those balancing ideas which Dara was talking about, I think the courts would want to have a very broad range of discretion when it came to looking at the government's policies during the pandemic and the lockdown itself, because it's clear that there is different competing scientific models about what the epidemic is doing, how we should react to it. There are different competing economic arguments that are being made. There are different and competing medical opinions about how many lives are being affected and potentially lost as a result of people not suffering from coronavirus who aren't getting to hospital to have their cancer diagnosis or whatever. And those are such broad questions that I think when it comes to, you know, the court's willingness to try to assess those, that the government will be given, as I say, a great range of a margin of discretion. But I think the more specific a group you're talking about, the more real and immediate risk that is identified, the more willing a court may be to say, well, actually, there wasn't sufficient regard given to the risk to victims of domestic abuse or whatever it is. But it, in a sense, there would be that sort of funnel of willingness to engage. The broader the issue, the more competing policies within that decisions, in those government decisions, the less the courts are likely to want to interfere. But the narrower the point, the greater that willingness to interfere.
Since the beginning of the series of lockdowns, circuit breakers and so on, there have been particular challenges for all sorts of legal procedures, including coroners' inquests. Coroners certainly can't assemble juries in a time of plague. The particularly tricky thing for a coroner is that they have to be physically in court for the inquest to be properly constituted. Emma Louise Fenelon, who's just finished a month-long inquest herself, asked Peter Skelton QC how to investigate deaths under Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights.
I think Article 2 is going to mandate some form of inquiry into deaths which may result from systemic failures by the UK government to manage the pandemic, either before it became a pandemic or during the course of its life. And the reason for that really is because that's exactly what Article 2 is designed to do. It's designed to function at a state level where the state is obliged to protect its citizens. If the systems that the state operates or puts in place are insufficient, then Article 2 requires some form of procedural investigation and a compliance investigation. In other words, one which is held in public, which has participation on the part of victims and which hears proper evidence and which comes to conclusions. To some extent, inquests, of course, discharge that on a low level when it comes to local deaths or even a group of deaths. Inquests can deal with small matters, relatively small matters. When it comes to larger matters, a public inquiry would be a classic vehicle by which Article 2 would be discharged. And I feel it's going to be inevitable that it's going to be required.
Staying with inquests for a moment, may I remind you of the lurid case of Novichok, dramatised in the BBC series The Salisbury Poisonings. Matt Hill at One Crown Office Row has been considering the Skripal assassination attempt, which ended in the death of innocent bystander Dawn Sturges. Her family challenged the findings of the coroner at her inquest. They argued that the investigation should have reached further into the doings of the Russian state.
The enhanced investigative duty under Article 2 is a very lengthy subject, but in brief, it's this. Article 2 protects the right to life, and it imposes certain obligations on states, the most obvious one of which is not to take life unless there is a lawful and justifiable reason, such as a police officer firing a gun in self-defence. Article 2 also places investigative duties on the state. Now, at the lowest level, one can see this as an extension of what was already there in the domestic law. You can't have people dying violent and unnatural deaths and those being left uninvestigated. So the criminal justice system is part of the state meeting its Article 2 obligations. But where there is an argument that it is state agents who have caused the death, either the classic example being the police officer who fires the bullet, either directly like that or indirectly by not doing something. So again, classic example is not providing sufficient care in prisons to prevent suicide. Then in those circumstances, the state has an enhanced investigative duty where it must look at what its agents have done. And it is in those circumstances that the inquest becomes a Middleton inquest and looks not just at the means by which somebody died, so in the case of a prisoner, suicide, but also the circumstances in which that person died. For example, was that prisoner given sufficient care and placed on sufficient safeguards to prevent the suicide?
And just staying with Article 2 for the moment, but with Sturgis and Litvinenko in mind, what is the obligation on the state when it's agents of another state who are suspected of being behind the death?
This was a question that was addressed directly by the High Court in the recent judicial review application. It was argued before them that Article 2 placed an obligation on the British state to investigate, an enhanced investigative obligation on the British state, to look at the actions of people who were thought to be agents of the Russian state. It was an argument which didn't win favour with the court, who found that there was no authority that supported it, and also that it was somewhat at odds with the principal purpose of Article 2, which, as I've just said, is about a state looking at its own agents. I think it was quite an ambitious argument to run, and the courts were unpersuaded on that, though, as we will hear, they were persuaded on arguments which are more firmly rooted in the domestic statutory legislation.
With so many people working at home for the best part of the year, our job at LawPod UK was made rather easier by being able to approach potential interviewees who might otherwise have been unattainable. One of them was Robert Spano, who took over the presidency of the European Court of Human Rights earlier this year. Judge Spano has been giving some thought to the application of law to the kind of government decision-making that has become increasingly reliant on artificial intelligence. I asked him why we seem to be so much more content with AI as a diagnostic tool for medical disease than we are with algorithms in the legal and administrative process.
As you say, I'm pretty sure when it comes to disease, we don't really care about transparency, accountability, or the legitimacy of the diagnostic process so long as the rate of success is as close to 100%. We want the diagnostic process when it comes to whether we are sick or not to actually find the truth. And the truth is an objective entity when it comes to diagnosing disease. But how is this different in the law? It's different because the end result in the law, whether a right exists or not, if we take in particular the human rights field, which is the one that I focus on, of course, there are multiple manifestations of the way in which algorithms can impact law. But if we focus on human rights law, the question whether a right exists or not, whether a person is convicted or not, is to a large extent morally and societally acceptable on the basis of certain rule of law principles. We ask ourselves, one, a person must be able to know who took the decision, the principle of accountability. Secondly, we require that a person must know on what factual and legal basis the decision has been taken. This is simple transparency and legitimacy of the decision-making process. And finally, in the law, as we know, it is all about justification and maintaining equilibrium, equality, that decisions, similar decisions affecting person A are also taken in the same manner and on the same basis for person B. That is a core fundamental underlying principle to retain the integrity of law. So this, at the end of the day, a person must be able to know why the decision was taken and to what extent the decision compares to other similar decisions, the principles of justification and non-discrimination. Now, when it comes to algorithmic tools, they are inherently in tension with these concepts. Why? Because, for example, it is very difficult for the person who is the subject of a decision taken by an automated tool to understand how the tool works. What are the data sets, we call them data sets, that have been incorporated into the algorithmic tool, the code which has been programmed to be able to digest an infinite amount of data sets. So it all depends on the interaction between the algorithmic tool, the code, and the data set that is put into the algorithm to process. Now, the way that is done, the way the system works, is very difficult to explain, even to the most technically proficient people. And not to speak of, not to disparage you and me, Rosalind, but we are lawyers. We are perhaps not, certainly not me, technically proficient in understanding the fundamentals of coding for algorithmic purposes. So that really creates a tension when a person receives a decision promulgated by government, where in fact no human has actually taken part in the decision-making process.
Moving on to a completely unrelated topic here. In the past 3 years, the rate and volume of rape prosecutions in the United Kingdom have fallen steeply, collapsing to the lowest level since records began. In June this year, Emma Louise Fenelon talked to Jennifer McLeod from Brick Court Chambers about one of her cases. A rape victim charity, EVOR, sought to challenge the CPS rape prosecution policy, but were denied permission. And then the CPS went after the charity for costs.
It is really tragic that in the end EVOR was ordered to pay a significant bill for costs. The bill was essentially picked up by rape victims themselves. I think it was particularly egregious in this case because one didn't have the opportunity to get a permission decision on the paper and then decide whether to go forwards. We had to go forwards to the full hearing without that original permission decision, and so we were left on the hook for costs, albeit on the Mount Cook principles, but for costs that were very significant in the end.
Sadly, other forms of abuse have been on the increase since the pandemic took hold, and families have been isolated and confined by lockdown rules. But even before all this, there have been concerns about child abuse in this country, so much so that an inquiry was set up to investigate the question of child sexual abuse within minority religions. Solicitor Richard Scorer acted for the largest group of victims and survivors in the inquiry. Emma, who was also involved in the hearing, asks Richard about the significance of power and authority in certain religious communities.
It is certainly true that in some of the communities that we're looking at here, the social power and influence and authority of religious institutions and religious leaders is much, much greater than we might realise. The role and influence of religious figures goes well beyond simply their formal role in performing religious ceremonies. An example of this that we gave in the inquiry was the role of the Beth Din, the Jewish religious courts, in ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities. The Beth Din, the Jewish religious courts, have a set of formal powers to do with things like, you know, approving food as kosher food and so on. So formal powers like that. But the point that we made is that they have a much, much wider influence than that, and they involve themselves in all sorts of issues within the community that go well beyond their formal remit. And that includes things like how to deal with allegations of child abuse. So this is a big issue, and it's an important issue, I think, for the inquiry to understand. I'm sure it does understand as it looks at how you address the issues of safeguarding in these settings.
The offence of coercive and controlling behaviour in a marriage where one party, usually the wife, is clearly a victim of gaslighting and oppression. In highly observant Jewish communities, where a man does not agree to a divorce, or what is known as a get, the Beth Din will refuse the woman the requisite documentation. These women are trapped in unhappy marriages, and they're known as agenu, or chained women. Anthony Metzer QC of Goldsmith Chambers happened on the idea of using a private prosecution to persuade a Jewish man to grant his wife a divorce.
as a criminal barrister, I came up with this idea, which frankly, I was surprised no one appeared to have thought of it before. But I said, well, why don't we think about this? Because at the time, it was about 2 or 3 years ago we met. So it was quite new that the 2015 Act had come into place. And I said, why don't we think about controlling or coercive behaviour in an intimate relationship under Section 76 of the 2015 Act? And it really went from there. I chose which was, I thought, the strongest case. And we decided then to launch a private prosecution on the back of this offence to argue that the refusal to provide the get was one, but obviously not the only, and it couldn't be just the only, but one feature in relation to coercive and controlling behaviour.
Had the prosecution proceeded, what other evidence do you think you might have needed to obtain?
We looked carefully, or I looked carefully, at what the CPS regarded as the sort of features and factors that we were regarded as controlling or coercive behaviour, which are slightly different in definition. We felt this case was strong in relation to other features. Good examples, which were shorter physical violence, as you rightly observe, but came within that, there were aspects in which he was isolating her from her family. There were aspects of financial control. There was unreasonable behaviour in other regards, sexually, but not just sexually, in other respects, which would have been additional features, which would have been important in terms of being able to pursue a successful prosecution.
Staying with cultural divisions, Emma followed up on the question of racial inequality at the bar with Martin Ford, QC, who recalls an edgy moment in a judicial review case he wasn't particularly confident about.
I had a northern judge in a JR. I couldn't possibly lose on the law, but my merits were awful, and he was struggling to find a way to get me down, which I quite admired him for, because I didn't really like my case very much, but there we are. And eventually he said to me, Mr. Ford, can I approach this with some typical northern bluntness? And I thought, okay, here we go. We're now going to get, you know, the professional northerner going for the sort of common sense view. And I said, yes, my lord, as long as I don't have to greet your lordship's approach with typical West Indian exuberance. And he looked at me and he said, touché. So that was a bit of banter, I guess. But, you know, it kind of worked, because I thought, well, if you're going to play the professional northerner card, then I'm allowed to play the, you know, the professional happy-go-lucky card.
Touché, Martin Ford, indeed. And just to finish off on a highly serious matter, you may have heard Emma's interview with Lord Anderson of Ipswich, better known to us as David Anderson QC, about the flaws of delegated legislation, where the government rushes in statutory instruments and other rules in response to Brexit and COVID without proper scrutiny by Parliament. One of the problems is that these bits and pieces of subordinate legislation can only be nullified rather than amended. Most parliamentarians flinch from such a nuclear solution. To give you an idea, there have only been 17 statutory instruments that have been subject to the negative resolution by Parliament, out of many thousands in the past 60 years that have passed. All that remains is the quintessentially English notion of, quotes, regret debate, close quotes, of which Lord Anderson has some experience.
A motion of regret is a great way of letting off steam. You could hope maybe to give the government a really hard time, but at the end of the day, even if you get the motion through, all it says is that we regret that this statutory instrument going to become law. I remember a debate on one in which the Public Law Project, in fact, was incredibly helpful in briefing everybody. This is a statutory instrument that removed the establishment rights of EEA nationals and their right to provide services without there even having been an impact assessment. And we had a full dress debate with a regret motion. We had lawyers like Lord Panic and I who started off sort of softening up the government. And then the big bazookas were unleashed. There were former Lord Chief Justices, former Supreme Court Justices saying this was all dreadful. And then finally, there was a bee in the Lord's Chamber. I don't know who let it in, but it attacked the minister and he started hopping around the dispatch box. At that point, we really felt, you know, this is parliamentary pressure at its best, and we had him on the run. But at the end of the day, as Alex rightly says, these SIs are just not set aside. And the reason for that, really, the last one we set aside in the Lords was in 2015. The reason is that our power to set them aside is actually too strong to be usable, because the Parliament Acts do not apply, which means that if we strike it down, there is no way of reintroducing it to the Commons. And since we are the unelected House, most people think it would be, certainly in the Commons, a very strange thing if we were able simply to kill it on the basis of not having any sort of democratic mandate.
Now our roundup comes at last to an end. With various vaccines promised to us in our Christmas stockings, and as far as we can see at the moment, a slight dip in the number of COVID cases, the C word may not dominate conversations, the press, broadcasting and social media quite to the extent as it was in 2020. But rest assured that the pandemic and the government's response to it will run rampant in the courts for months, ranging from challenges to the legality of the lockdown, to the inadequacy of PPE provision at the start of the year. In fact, shortly after this episode goes up, there's likely to be a decision by the Supreme Court whether COVID business interruption losses can be recovered from insurers. Watch this space.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.